Chariot Solutions Developer News, number 16, for Tuesday, May 25th, 2010. I'm Ken Rimple.
I'm Eric Snyder.
And we're here to talk about stuff we think is interesting in tech world. Let's see. So if you want to follow along with some of the bookmarks, we lately have been having a little bit of an issue keeping up with the dev news. I think we're all getting pretty busy. So we're going to try to recalibrate and maybe make this every other week or something. So you'll see in the tags, for example, we have a lot of things tagged with 16. We're going to cherry pick from that this week, I think, just because otherwise we'll be here for 2 hours. And some of the news will get stale. So anyway, let's get into it. Let me just start off with something about Git workflow. Now, Eric, I know you're a Git fan. We talked about it a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that a lot of people get confused by if they're working in, let's say, Subversion before is how to deal with Git's workflow as opposed to the Subversion workflow. So this article, which is by Yehuda Katz on – actually, I really like his blog. What is it? Katz Got Your Tongue, I think. But this is actually just yehudakatz.com from May 13th. It's called My Common Workflow. He actually goes through and he discusses what happens when you have an upstream change in Subversion versus what would happen if you're doing it in Git. And he explains things like rebase when you do pull and all sorts of stuff. So if you haven't really done anything with Git before, or if you're just starting with Git and you want to get a feel for how it works in the real world, check that article out. You know, he has a whole table in here of, you know, for example, operations like what do you do on Subversion versus Git for copying or cloning your repository? What about preparing for changes, updating from the remote, resolving conflicts, rolling back if there's a problem, which I think that's one of the key things a lot of people don't know how to do right. in general in right. version control. Eric, you have a couple on Python.
Well, this is one of the things we're going to
talk about. Yeah, absolutely.
Django 1.2 is now out. I know we talked about it on an earlier podcast, so I'm not going to go over all the, you know, the list of features, but it's finally out. I shouldn't say finally. I mean, it was about a 9-month release schedule, so a lot of goodness in there. I guess the big thing is multi-database. That's probably the biggest item in there. You know, lots of just really cool things.
So back to the multi-database. So if you've got a Python app and you want to go and query two different sources and two different, I guess it's like an object relational mapping in a way, kind of like an active record. Is that what the database mapping is?
Previously, Django's ORM, you couldn't easily use more than one database.
Right.
So now, not only is it permissible, so then there's new APIs to say, I want this model to be associated with this database, mm-hmm. or for like, just for this transaction, I want this to be associated with this database. So if you have a situation where you have multi, like a master-slave type situation, like master right, slave read kind of a thing, mm-hmm. you can do that really easily now. You can create these router things, and you can basically say, you know, whenever I'm doing this read-only transaction, you know, you can hit any of the read-only slaves or anything like that. So it's just sort of baked in now. It was more difficult before. It's kind of roll your own.
Right. And they don't do anything like cross-database transactions or XA or anything like that.
No. Nothing like that. But so that's very, very – I know a lot of people were looking for that. And I guess the next big thing is model validation. So if you're used to Rails, that's what you have. You have model validation. So, you know, basically – it's very useful, but in a lot of situations you get into trouble because you have, you know, in a specific state, you want certain validation conditions to exist, and in other states you don't. So Django always had very good form-level validation, but now it's got a good combination of both form and model validation.
Gotcha. So. Which one would you like to take next? Do you want to do the HTML5 or the Reddit? Well,
the HTML5 one is good. So,
let's get there.
You know, we've talked about this HTML5, how important it is, and but so there's a book that's in the works by Mark Pilgrim, and a couple things. The link is diveintohtml5.org, and you know this is one of those books in progress that is thrown up online that you can look at. And I'm definitely going to buy this book, the actual maybe the physical book. I'm not sure the PDF from O'Reilly when it comes out. But first thing I noticed is the actual. Site itself is beautiful. It's like very well styled.
It's gorgeous.
Isn't it? It's fantastic. Yeah. It's got like this medieval kind of feel to it.
Yeah. I love the sculpted font there.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
So that aside.
Yeah,
just
right.
That caught my attention.
I'll probably make it easy to read.
Yeah. But the contents, it's just fantastic. So it's not dry and technical. I mean, it is technical, but it's not dry at all. Mark does a bit of... I think he called it email archaeology. So he actually digs back into the history of HTML, the early days of the web, like 93, 94, and he starts documenting where some of these decisions were made, so you'll understand why HTML5 and why things they are the way they are. This is really a fantastic book.
Wow.
So far, anyway, I mean, from what I see.
Well, now you give me something to actually go read.
Yeah, I know. I couldn't stop reading yesterday.
That's great.
Yeah, illustrations are great. I mean, this is it.
I'm tagging it right now.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Okay, great. Let's see. Coming into a couple other things. Let me jump over to Flex versus Java. You know, a lot of developers, for a while at least, and I think probably still, are putting front ends in Flex, just because it's a rich internet application front end.
Does Steve Jobs know this?
Steve Jobs won't allow it. Okay. So, you know, you and I have iPads, so there's no way. But for corporate clients who are doing Flex, a lot of the people who are doing the Flex front ends generally are Java developers, mm-hmm. or .NET developers, I suppose. And there's a nice little article called Flex and Java Differences. James Ward is we've actually had him on the show twice, and actually in the evening podcast as well, and the web framework shootouts. But anyway, so James is a friend of Chariot, and his website's called jamesward.com, and it's titled RIA Cowboy. Anyway, so he works for Adobe, and he has a quick thing on Flex and Java differences. So basically, Flex supports pure properties. So when you create an object and you know, create a property with a particular name, you don't have to do setters and getters unless you want to. Mm-hmm. And if you put the setters and getters in, you can still use the dot notation to get to the object, and it will just automatically flip in to use the setters and getters. So there's a little blog entry that I'll put a link in for there. So that's a nice little handy thing. In other languages, we've got Rails 3 tutorials. By Greg Pollack. So on the 12th, he pointed out, I guess it's coming up in a week or two, three, is RailsConf 2010 in Baltimore. And they put together a list of all the sessions they're going to do, and it's all the different Rails 3 tutorials. So if you wanted to go check out Rails 3, you could do that. Also, I'm going to do a quick plug for Chariot. We have a training course coming up for Rails 3 with Engine Yard, 22nd through 24th of June. Actually, two trainers from Engine Yard are coming out, and it'll be their first delivery in the Philadelphia area. And we're actually certifying to teach it going forward as well. So if you can't make the one in Baltimore, take a look at chariotsolutions.com, go to our training site, and you can sign up there just as a side plug. But anyway, so RailsConf is coming up, and apparently they've got this whole set of tutorials from Envy Labs to check out. Why don't we talk a little bit about PyPy? What is PyPy?
PyPy is very cool. It's PyPy and PyPI are two different things. So if you hear it on the audio, PyPI is the Python Package Index, or the Cheese Shop, as it's formerly known as, which is
Monty Python direct reference.
It's the repository for Python packages.
Right.
So, mm-hmm. But PyPy is it's an implementation of Python written in Python.
So, how meta?
Yeah. And so there's an article by Alex Gaynor, and Alex, anybody who is involved with Django is probably familiar with Alex. He's got I'll plug his podcast. It's called Django Dose. He's a member of that podcast team, and cool. It's very good. So he talks about PyPy, and he says it's the future of Python. So right now Python, you know, there's multiple implementations, but I think 90-something percent of people are using the C implementation of Python, right? So commonly known as CPython. But the reason Alex is advocating PyPy is that since it's written in number one, it's written in Python, so it's easy to understand, because it's much easier, obviously, to read Python code than it is C. It's simpler, easier to maintain. But the thing is, since it's written in Python, basically the actual final implementation can be anything. So you can – the PyPy can generate Java bytecode. It's on the way. It doesn't – it's not quite there yet for mm-hmm. that. It can generate CLR bytecode. Basically, it can be the base for any runtime. So if you think about that, that's really cool. So and right now, it's actually a faster implementation in many respects of Python than CPython.
So let me see if I can completely get this wrong. I'm good at that, by the way. So let's say you took PyPy and you generated JVM bytecode. You could run Python on the JVM.
Right, and you could do that now with Jython.
Right.
So, I mean, that exists.
But they could do that with this, basically, by just retargeting the interpreter.
So, that kind of is what Alex is getting at. One of his main points is that if we had one sort of canonical implementation, is that even the right use of the word canonical
there?
That
sounds right. Maybe.
There's no reason to necessarily have all these different implementations. You know, I mean, you could, obviously. There always will be, but... you can have a stackless Python, which is it's a version of Python that's out there right now. It's a whole different C Python implementation that has supports tasklets and that whole actor model workflow kind mm-hmm. of thing. But it has to be a whole different implementation because the guts of it are so different. But with PyPy, it's just a switch on the compiler.
This sounds very Godelish or Bach to me.
Yeah.
It's like, but it's very cool.
Yeah. So it's kind of like Rubinius on the Ruby side. So.
Oh, because Rubinius is written in Ruby?
It's written in Ruby.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well,
that's
for the most
wild.
Part, yeah.
If you're a Python person, you're probably going to love this. And if not, you're going to scratch your head, maybe be intrigued and find out about Python through here. You never know.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. All right. Let me go to the boring side of life. Builds and build tools. It's not really all that boring, but it certainly can be. Maven 3.0. Maven has been going through some re-architecture from version 2 to version 3. So a couple things are going to happen with Maven. Maven 3 is a drop-in replacement 99% for Maven 2, but they've completely gutted the internals and changed things around. There are some constraints you have to worry about coming up in 3.1. It'll actually be potentially breaking changes, but they're trying to make it as much as possible a drop-in change.
Right.
But one thing I didn't even know about Maven is that in Maven, you can actually embed Groovy scripts now and mm-hmm. Just do whatever you want and get access to the whole POM object model and throw them in the lifecycle. But anyway, Matthew McCullough had a meeting at the Denver Jug and kind of blotted out what Maven 2 to Maven 3 differences are going to be. So one of the things, for example, is that they want you to actually wire in the versions of all your dependencies. And so that actually in Maven, starting in Maven 3, you can't just let dependencies float and hope that you'll get the right versions. And the reason for that is because everyone's on different versions of Maven.
Right.
Right. And so since the plugins really don't care what version of Maven you're on generally, you can set those versions. You probably should, but they're going to make that an enforced change. All of this is getting to the point where they can start doing some really cool things.
That's going to cause some problems with adoption.
I think it will.
A lot of big enterprises are really going to have I'm predicting they're going to have a hard time.
Well, just doing the upgrade.
I think
I think it's kind of the medicine you need in a way because a lot of the problems that you run into with Maven is because everyone has different versions.
Oh, I agree. It's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
There's a lot of these bigger companies are not exactly flexible.
Yeah. Yeah. They move at a slower pace. So I would assume that those companies are going to go toe in slowly. So anyway, so take a look at that. They have a whole concept in Maven 3 where they actually want to do things like mix-ins so you can kind of add features to a build, a Maven shell. Which I guess it's an add-on to Maven 3 where you can keep it running and mm-hmm. just issue commands to it so it doesn't take all that ramp up and tear down
time.
Oh,
that's very cool.
So that should be interesting. And that's actually out on GitHub, Maven shell.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll put a link to that stuff in the show notes. So anyway, Maven 3, it's coming down the road. And actually, if you're like me, one of the people that had Maven 2.0 something
mm-hmm.
On your machine, you should upgrade to 2.2.something
mm-hmm.
because they've fixed things with things like offline mode
mm-hmm.
And streamlined it a little bit and fixed the number of bugs. So if you've been stuck in 2.07, 2.08 land, you should probably upgrade yourself to the 2.2 release because it really is backward compatible completely.
I wonder how backward compatible the plugin API is. So if you've written a lot of your own, I wonder what that's going to be.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's funny, tools like Gradle where they don't really have that need yet. It's not an issue because they'll break the whole thing from point 8 to point 9 in order to add a feature because they're not 1.0 release yet. So a lot of these competing tools are kind of early on. They can get away with kind of refactoring themselves ad nauseum if they need to. It's interesting. The Java build world is moving. For a long time, it was just Ant and Maven, and now it seems like there's a lot of competition.
Well, what's interesting is that it's such a huge topic.
It is.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, building your software should almost be an afterthought. It shouldn't be there are entire careers built on
CI and build.
Yeah, exactly.
There really are, and it's funny because Java, if you think about it, it's a billion jars out there that you can pull in. And so part of the problem is there's a billion jars, and each of them have their own specific dependency requirements.
Right.
you know, and so you kind of have to build up a community around that, because just the way Java works with the class loader, and, you know, it's like with so much flexibility comes a lot of potential pain.
Sure.
You know, because there never really was a standard. Whereas I guess if you take something like Gem, or I guess the Python packaging, they've got their own little mechanisms for installing things.
Well, they have their own mess.
And I'm sure, yeah. But you know, it's funny at the web framework shootout. What was it? The guy, was it Yehuda Katz? Yeah, we're on Rails. We don't have that problem.
You know, you can usually get away with saying that.
You can get away with saying that.
Sometimes.
Right. But don't gems build? And I think even in Rails, like you, or in Ruby, I know there was a gem that wouldn't compile properly for me at one point because I was on a Mac. And
oh, sure. Yeah.
You know, you get into things like that. So
they're native extensions to some of the gems.
It's fun to listen to everyone say that we don't really have X problem, because in every environment, there's something, right?
Yeah.
Yep. All right. That was a good long rant, right?
Sure.
All right. Let's see here. So we talked about Django. What else do you want to talk about on your list?
Reddit. So I think we might have mentioned it before, but if you don't know what Reddit is, it's modeled – I don't know if it's modeled after Dig, but if you think about Dig.com, it's basically – people submit links, articles, posts, whatnot, you know, images, whatever, and people get to comment and vote on them. And there's, you can search on them and subcategorize things and stuff like that. Before anybody jumps to Reddit.com, I just have to warn them in advance. It can either be extremely funny, incredibly offensive, or both. You have to have a really good sense of humor to visit Reddit. So just letting you know that. But anyway.
Oh, yes.
it happens to be written largely in Python, but that's not why I like it so much.
Uh-huh.
So they serve up about 270 million page views a month as of, I guess, middle of this month.
Yeah, that's really good.
Which is a hell of a lot of traffic. So,
rather popular. Yeah,
extremely popular. So there's an article by Steve Huffman, who's a co-founder of did he actually write that article? No, he gave a presentation. So this is somebody describing Steve Huffman's presentation on the lessons that Steve learned while building and growing Reddit to 7.5 million users per month, 270 million page views per month, and over 20 database servers. So I know they're Python. I forget the Python web framework they use. It's not Django. Is it Turbo Gears? I forget. My Pylons? I don't remember, but
some web framework.
Yeah, and I believe they're MySQL, Memcache. That, you know, that mm-hmm. LAMP derivative stack. So,
wow, I'm looking at some of these lessons here. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, it's funny that you look through these lessons, and a lot of them directly contradict everything you learned in school. You know what I mean? So, I'm dating myself. I mean, you know, maybe these lessons aren't taught the same way anymore. But, you know, so. I'll just go over them really quick, what Steve was saying. So lesson one, crash often.
Yes, restart failed and cancerous services.
Yeah, so basically don't – I mean, you know, obviously spend the time to have stable services, but expect them to die. And expect them not only to die, watch them closely, because they may not die, but they can certainly hurt you. They can start consuming too much memory or – disk I.O. or whatever. So just watch them and just write your services in such a way that they're prepared to go away at any time and restart.
Hey, here's a cool thing. Supervise. I never saw Supervise. Then again, I'm not in this world, but apparently this is some sort of daemon tool called Supervise, and you can basically watch something. And wow, that's really cool.
Yeah, okay. So, you know.
Little things like that. Yeah.
Be prepared to kill stuff and make sure things are recoverable, whatever services you have.
Mm-hmm.
Lesson two, separation of services. It's not exactly groundbreaking advice there. But, you know, group like processes together and data on different boxes. Well, okay. Yeah, no kidding. This one, I think, at one point would have been controversial, and maybe it is to some people, but basically says lesson three, open schema. The essence of this lesson is don't worry about the schema.
I'm getting my boxing gloves on.
I had
XDBA.
You know what? It's so
I can't hold on.
I went to college in the early 90s. Okay. And, you know, I would have been shot for making a statement like that in class. But I think what we're learning is if your back end is still primarily SQL or based, you know, any of the relational databases, you know, having a schema full, you know, model, you suffer a little bit in terms of scalability and maintenance. If you've got a site like Reddit, remember, this is Reddit.
Yeah, okay? This is a very specific.
This is an atypical case. Yeah. So,
but I don't disagree with you. I think that there are definitely cases where if you need to quickly change things and you're locked in a schema, you become in DBA, please, sir, may I have another mode.
And it's not just that. So, for example, it gives an example. Adding a column to 10 million rows.
Yeah.
It takes locks, and he says it doesn't work.
Well, yeah. I mean,
well,
that makes sense.
And in their case, it doesn't work. So, you know.
What can't go down is part of the issue with them. I mean, if Reddit goes down because they're adding a column,
sure.
That's a big issue, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So they have a thing
totally
table.
Makes sense.
Get this. They have a thing table and a data table. That's it.
I like it.
So, you know, it flies in the face of everything, you know, you were taught. And, you know, you lose all the benefit of foreign keys and check validations and all that kind of stuff. But it keeps Reddit alive and running, and it works for them. So.
Wow. And they're running this on MySQL?
I think so.
Jeez.
I think it's MySQL. I could be wrong about that.
You know, it's funny because you were taught, like you were saying, I was in college in the late 80s to early 90s. So
I know.
I'm just a little older, but only a little. And as we work on our broken hips. But anyway, the thing I was taught was, you know, in terms of modeling data anyway, is don't make deep tables. Don't forget, that was because the engines at the time couldn't handle deep data. They really couldn't.
I know, but I mean, I have nightmares about, you know, exams on fourth normal, Boyce COD normal form.
Oh, the,
nobody
the key,
cares anymore.
The key, nothing but the key. So help me, COD.
Yeah. I'm not saying throw it out. Obviously, you know, if you're modeling relational data, you know, 99% of the time you can do it that way.
But what's funny is so I'll go on my rant. Here, you want to hear my rant?
Go ahead.
All right. So my rant is getting crap out of my database is painful if I'm not a developer once I go to these tools.
Yeah.
So, for example, you've got your typical, and I am not saying that this is right, but I'm just giving you my view, is you've got an application for a customer.
Yeah.
Customer now comes back and says, I need reports.
Yeah.
So let's say they waited till the end of the project and they say, we need these 55 reports. And you go,
right. And you just have
so
one
much.
Name value paired table.
Yeah. Now what? Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, otherwise you could say, well, okay, I'll make a, hopefully you make a copy of, but let's say you make a copy of or a warehouse or a data mart or God knows what,
yeah.
Something they can then query with query tools and
sure.
Keep it out of the database.
Yeah.
You could still use SQL. So at least SQL can get you to the point.
No,
point
I hear.
I mean, my angle on that is I need that kind of tool for this world.
Sure.
For me to feel comfortable saying in a business
situation. Yeah, but if you were serving up 270 million page views.
Exactly. It's a whole different
game.
You'd
say, screw it. This doesn't work.
Exactly.
I don't have a choice.
Yep.
You know?
So as you said, it's the prescription is based on the sickness you're dealing with, and
exactly.
So their sickness is we got to share content with everyone all the time, and it can't go down.
Right.
Perfect solution for that.
Sure.
Yeah. And so it's funny, you know, everyone gets in their high horse about DB, you know, relational, non-relational. It's use the right tool for the right job, and you know, I'm totally with it on this.
Just you know, I guess what I get out of this is don't feel bad about making compromises like this.
Well, yeah, you have to, though. Because otherwise, how could they possibly make this work in a fourth normal form, which I don't think anyone really gets to, luckily, in the world.
Yeah.
Send me an email. See if we're listening.
Send an email to Ken.
Yes, to crimple at chariotsolutions.com.
Yes.
But anyway, so that's cool. All right.
Lesson four, keep it stateless.
Yep.
Yeah, no kidding. Lesson five, memcache. Memcache everything. Is what they say.
That is fascinating.
So, I mean, you know, I've heard, you know, obviously you've heard that before. So, I mean.
But as this thing gets bigger and bigger and bigger, can they really memcache everything? I guess they would age things out of cache.
It's cheaper to do that.
Sure. They must have a finite limit to the cache, though. Yeah. Cool.
Oh, maybe they use Postgres. Okay. Lesson six, store redundant data. Again, it flies in the face of, conventional, old conventional wisdom.
Yeah, it does. But you know what? Even back in the warehousing and the reporting days, you used to,
sure.
You know, denormalize for performance.
Right.
So,
I mean, it's good. Steve is saying the key to speed is to pre-compute everything and cache it.
Which
in
you've been saying for a while.
Sense.
Yeah. When you originally gave a talk to us about almost 2 years ago now on Google App Engine and the database.
Yeah, App Engine.
And
yeah.
That was a really good talk because you had basically gone through there and said, look, it's different.
Yeah.
You know, the world is different. It's much faster to get than it is to put.
Yes.
So, and maybe that's the case for this too, especially if you have 20 million rows or God
sure.
knows what. Pre-compute it, store the result.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Lesson seven, work offline. Do the minimal amount of work on the back end and tell the user you are done.
Hmm.
So, you know, again, nothing totally earth-shattering. It's just don't feel bad about making compromises if
by
you
the,
have to.
Yeah, by the way, high scalability is one Joel Confino, one of our buddies, It works at Chariot here, brings up all the time this site. This site's really good if you have to scale.
Yes.
Fantastic articles. So I highly recommend going back there and mining that site for ideas if you're supporting large applications. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see here. Another one that I tagged recently is Java Exceptions and Flex. This one is by Cornell Krianga on dzone.com. And he goes through basically a use case where he has a web service that's going to return a result, and then he wants to put error reporting in the result, and he calls the remote object tag, and then shows the answer, and he kind of shows you what you'd have to do to actually deal with it. And there's even an exception translator that you can put in with – this is using BlazeDS on Java. So the idea is BlazeDS is a remoting framework that uses Adobe AMF format, which is their binary remoting format, mm-hmm. and exposes Java methods as remote services as opposed to just a pure web service call. So you're really doing binary remoting back and forth from Flex. You click a button.
Gotcha.
It sends a message over to Flex, gets an answer. Well, it looks like in here they're using Spring BlazeDS, which on top of that, basically Spring says, okay, here's BlazeDS. Now we're going to make it easier to set up. And so there's a Spring library for BlazeDS. Mm-hmm. So if you have a Spring application, you install this particular jar and you can wire up basically BlazeDS methods through Spring by basically pointing to Spring Beans and saying, remote this.
Gotcha.
So anyway, he goes through a little tutorial on doing that in here. And that's an interesting little article. I must have been Flex happy that week. Mm-hmm. All right. Do we have anything else from the Django? Or
where's the Silverlight love?
What, a Silverlight?
Yeah. I don't see any Silverlight love from anybody.
Talk to me about Silverlight.
I don't know anything about Silverlight.
Oh, hey, here's one I heard. Here's a side note. Hey, all you developers out there in developer land, if you go to Mozilla.com, do you guys know about this? Plugin check? Go to Mozilla.com/plugin check. I heard this on This Week in Something or Other from Leah Laporte. But if you go there, it actually runs on your browser, and it checks to see what the versions of all your plugins are. And if you need to update them because of security issues or what have you. So it'll say your Silverlight plugin, your Shockwave plugin, your
QuickTime
plugin.
Doesn't Firefox do that anyway?
Firefox does, but this will work with any browser.
So
if you're a Chrome fan or if you're a Safari fan, you can hit the same thing. And I guess it's just using some sort of common API or something. So I'll do this in Safari here. And it's coming back and it's saying... you've got all these cool plugins and they're all up to date. And then the ones it can't figure out, it says click a button to research them. And like things like QuickTime plugin, it still doesn't figure out how to do it.
Oh, that's pretty cool. So, the latest Flash vulnerability comes in.
Yeah, let's say you have children and they like to play Flash games on your laptop. I don't know any of these people except my own son. And, they play lots of Flash games and you're paranoid about what they're doing, especially if you're on Windows. You should go to this site and make sure you update it because there are all sorts of vulnerabilities that leak their way into these different plugins.
Sure.
So anyway, so that's pretty cool. I figured I'd throw that out as a side note.
I like that.
All right. Have we exhausted our list of our news articles? Or
I think so.
I think we have. All right. So a couple Chariot-related news items. If you go to ChariotSolutions.com, you want to find out about our education calendar. You can go on the left-hand side of the Chariot Solutions website, and you can see – you can view the whole calendar or view upcoming events. We basically have three upcoming courses. As I'm watching this thing load slowly on our network, we have an Intro to Rails course coming up, like I mentioned before, on June 22nd through 24th with the Engine Yard folks. That's going to be really interesting. In fact, on that one, we just recently upgraded our training room to IMAX, really nice IMAX with 22-inch screens, and they're going to do pair programming for everybody.
Oh, very cool.
And they're pair teaching,
oh.
Which is going to kick butt.
That is nice.
So if you don't know Rails and you want to learn Rails 3, that's the way to do it.
Yeah.
They're going to have an instructor in the front going through the lecture material and talking and that kind of stuff. And then when there's something to research, the instructor in the back is going to do things and they're going to project on the other wall.
Oh.
So you can get whiplash after the end of the week. But still, it's going to be a great class from that perspective. So that's coming up. Before that, we just talked about Maven. If you are struggling with Maven, there's a nice course that we actually just got certified to teach. From Sonatype. We had our own, but we decided to pony up with them because they've been developing Maven.
Sure.
And I don't have to write material anymore. So Sonatype Maven 101 and 201, which are the Maven mechanics and development infrastructure design, takes you. So they're only one-day courses, and they take you all the way from knowing nothing about Maven to being able to build your own POMs, put reports in the POMs, multi-module POMs and things like that. We talk about continuous integration with Hudson and dealing with repositories and things like that. So it's an interesting course. That's on June 15th and 16th. I'll be teaching that. And if you're a Spring maven, there is a Spring framework intro class coming up at the end, the middle of August, on August 10th, that I'll be teaching. That's actually, if you register now, you've basically got $400 or $300 off the price. So, you know, those are our education calendar things coming up in the fall. We're actually going to be offering some more advanced courses from Spring Source, like the Enterprise Integration course, as well as potentially down the road a little bit, the Rich Web course, which is a really good course as well. So anyway, I want to give that plug. And finally, we're going to have the content. It's been taking a while just because we're all so busy, but we're going to have some content from the show, from ETE 2010. Mostly it's the forums and panels because of the ones that, that translate well. We'll have that coming soon.
Cool.
All right. So that's the Chariot news. And so for everyone who's left, until next time, shameless plug division, right? Until next time, I'm Ken Rimple.
I'm Eric Snyder.
And make it a good week.